Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Micah Sargent and I speak with a few awesome folks about a few tech news stories that are making the rounds this week, wearables and how they could help detect COVID-19 symptoms early. T-Mobile finally completed its acquisition of Sprint. People are getting hitched on Zoom. There's Apple acquiring Dark Sky and Android users getting kind of bummed about it. And the Internet Archive has millions of ebooks to cure your boredom for free. All that next on Tech News Weekly. Tech News Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. You're focused on security, but are your employees? LastPass can ensure that they are by making access and authentication seamless. Visit LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 127, recorded Thursday, April 2nd, 2020.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Micah Sargent.
I'm Jason Howell. Today is not April Fool's Day. It is the day after. So this is the day that we do nothing but tell the truth.
Yes, the truth, nothing but the truth. So help you, everyone. I'm excited. We both survived the April Fool's holiday. I didn't see many jokes out there, I'm happy to say.
Oh, really? Yeah, what really wasn't that rough yesterday. And I think rightfully so. It felt normal. It felt good.
It was a good move. And speaking of good moves, folks are more than they have in the past, at least, turning to wearables as a way to track not just sort of fitness health and sleep health and sleep hygiene, rather, and things like that, but also tracking symptoms of COVID-19. So this is an interesting story involving a wearable that is near and dear to Twit's heart, at least, the Oura Ring. And I'm excited to have CNET's Lexi Savitas here to talk to us about Oura Ring and this new study. Hello, Lexi.
Hi, Micah. How are you going?
It's going well. How are you today?
Yeah, good. Thank you. With my plant babies behind me and enjoying the sunshine from the safety of my house.
Yes. We all, I know, are trying to do that. So let's dig right into things. First of all, what is the Oura Ring for folks out there who are listening who might not know? What is it that makes this ring unique? And what is its purpose in general?
So this is the Oura Ring. It looks like slightly thicker than a regular ring, and you can wear it on any finger. It's got a range of different sensors in it, so LEDs, an accelerometer, and a gyroscope, sort of regular stuff that you would expect on a wearable device that you would put on your wrist. However, this being a ring, it's able to be worn as you sleep. So it's primarily designed to sort of track your metrics as you sleep, to give you information on the quality of your sleep and the amount of your sleep. It can also track heart rate. It can track heart rate variability, respiration rate. And what really does set it apart from many other wearables is the fact that it can also track body temperature. It has some temperature sensors in it. And throughout the night, it's taking many, many readings. It's more than one a minute is what Oura tells me. And so essentially, these are averaged out. So it can give you a minute-by-minute reading of your body temperature throughout the night and then sort of give you an idea of whether or not it's raised or lowered compared to a baseline. It's not actually giving you like a Fahrenheit reading like you would if you were taking a reading from a regular thermometer, but it's giving you kind of an idea of your baseline and whether you are higher or lower in the morning. So the idea is you wear the Oura Ring while you sleep, and then in the morning you sync it with the app and you get some information on sort of basically a sleep score. So companies like Fitbit as well do have something similar. It gives you kind of an idea of how well you slept. It gives you a look in terms of your REM, your deep sleep, light sleep, any awake time, restlessness, and things like that. But the more interesting thing is the body temperature reading that I was just talking about, which is being used as part of this study with UCSF to see if they can detect early signs of COVID-19 using data from the Oura Ring, as well as your responses to a daily symptom survey.
Ah, so can you talk more about, do we know what sort of questions are asked in the survey that goes along with this reading?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am actually one of the participants that is taking part in the survey. And so the study is open to 2,000 healthcare workers from UCSF who are on the front line who may come into contact with the virus, as well as up to 150,000 Oura users around the world. That's their current user base. Oura told me that I think so far around 10,000 users have opted in. So if you do have one of these smart rings, you can be a part of the study. You just have to enroll from within the app. So essentially what happens is you open the Oura app in the morning, you kind of sync the ring, see your metrics, and then you're prompted to take this study. So you'll actually, it will have a little prompt saying, document your symptoms. It will take you to the page on the UCSF site. Obviously you've opted in and you'll be able to see if you can track your symptoms. Like you can basically say at the top, it says, I have no symptoms. And then it starts listing a big laundry list of any sort of symptoms that they're interested in, such as cough, sore throat, a fever, runny or itchy eyes, sneezing, things like that. Anything that might characterize a symptom, you can document. Then the next page also asks you if you took your temperature, and it asks you to input the reading if you did, not using the smart ring, but with another temperature device. And then finally, the last question is, have you been in contact with anyone else who has exhibited symptoms? So that's something that you do every day. And the researchers are hoping that that data combined with what is taken from the ring may be able to be used to detect early signs by essentially having an algorithm that can take all these data points and then use them to analyze whether or not someone may have signs of COVID-19. This is all very early stage research. So this is all just like a hypothesis. They just want to make that very, very clear that no wearable device currently is able to have like the gold standard in terms of detecting COVID. That's not possible. This is all just research in progress. So it's just a really interesting way that current wearables are kind of being repurposed and seeing if it might be possible to help fight new viruses and new diseases using technology that we already have.
So obviously this ring is being used in the way that you're talking about it, the kind of the way it was designed, more like a sleep sort of monitoring tool. Put it on at night, wake up in the morning, you've got your data. Is there any benefit to using this ring outside of just when you're sleeping? Like does the battery life on this ring or the data that's generated, like is it possible to wear this 24/7? And does that even benefit the study at all? Or is just kind of locking it into the nighttime good enough as far as they can tell at this early stage anyways?
The Oura ring itself is designed to be worn primarily as you sleep, but lots and lots of people do wear it throughout the day, and you're encouraged to in order to keep a track on things like, you know, exercise. It's like using an Apple Watch or a Fitbit. You know, it benefits your overall metrics in terms of health tracking for fitness and heart rate and so on if you wear it during the day. However, for this study in particular, they're only interested, I believe, in looking at the data that is gathered overnight, because that's when it's talking about body temperature. And that is one of the variables that the researchers believe might be an indicating factor of COVID-19. So yes, you absolutely can wear this throughout the day. And if you are an everyday user not enrolled in this study, you probably would want to be wearing it throughout the day, because it's going to be able to give you essentially more insight into what you're doing in terms of activity levels. I've actually been wearing it only at night because I'm only really interested in being a part of the study. But it's kind of interesting because when you wake up in the morning and it says, okay, it gives you your readiness score, it gives you your sleep metrics. And I feel kind of like a little shamed because you're like, well, you should aim to get around an 8-kilometer walk or like a 5-6 mile walk in today because you did nothing yesterday and take it off in the morning, right? And then I put on another wearable during the day on my wrist because I'm using that primarily for activity tracking. But I kind of don't really want to double dip wearing two at the same time. I should know that I'm wearing another one.
Yeah, you should be able to sync that data together. One of the things that I'm curious about, and I don't know if it's something that you may or may not know yet, if a person starts to say, yes, I do experience these symptoms, is that then going to lead them to some action items. I mean, there are other services, including an app that Apple launched recently. Most of the popular voice assistants and some online sites that you can say, these are the symptoms that I have. And then it starts to tell you, okay, well, here's where you can go get tested. Here's what you need to do next, et cetera. Is this the type of service that's going to give folks action items, or is this purely meant to collect data for this study?
That's a really great question. And at the moment, if you enroll in the study, so the researchers are only interested in those particular data points, your responses to the survey. You can also say, looking at your data, if you have taken a test for COVID-19 and document that as well within the app. However, it's really the most useful part of this is if you're not enrolled in the study, if you are using another wearable, is to really just like take a look at your data and just sort of, you will know whether or not, if you've been using it for a long time, whether or not something is a little bit off. Unrelated to this study is that a user in Finland who was wearing the Oura Ring did a similar thing. So he kind of knew that his baseline readings were, a certain number. And he used the Oura Ring overnight, woke up one morning, and then discovered that he had a fever overnight, but he didn't really feel it at all because it happened overnight. And he didn't really exhibit any other symptoms. Now, just this one reading, because he realized it was abnormal, prompted him to go get a test for COVID-19. He also did know, however, that he had traveled back from a COVID-19 hotspot in Austria. So he did have it in the back of his mind that maybe something might be off. The data encouraged him to go get a test. But this is really just extra information that you can use to be more informed. I just want to make it clear that this is not a substitute for a COVID-19 test. This is not a substitute for an actual medical consultation. So you just can use it just to be a little bit more informed about your particular situation, and then use that as an action point to seek treatment or seek a test if you need to.
Excellent. Well, Lexi Savitas, I want to thank you so much for joining us here today and for your great work over on CNET. If folks want to follow you online and see all the great stuff that you do, how can they do so?
You can find me on all of your favorite social media platforms. Twitter, it's just at my name, at Lexi Savitas. I'm on Instagram, Twitter. Also, I'm on YouTube on the CNET channel, so you can go check that out as well.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lexi,
for having me. Thanks. Take care.
Great talking with you. Take care. Stay safe and healthy. All right. It's no April Fool's joke. We've got one for you, and it actually happened. T-Mobile completed its long time coming merger with Sprint yesterday on April 1st. No indication whether that was purposeful or not. It's probably just a coincidence.
With John, but still. I don't think it's a coincidence with John.
Still, who the heck knows? Yeah, I wouldn't put it past him. You're absolutely right. The new T-Mobile will be the name going forward, the new T-Mobile. So you'll know that it's new. And we have Joe Marang from Android Central to help walk us through the deal. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, you bet. It's good to see you, man. This has been a while coming, at least a couple of years. The deal kicked off initially, or at least the starting of the deal kicked off in June 2018. Just kind of from a summary perspective, why did it take as long as it has? Why has it taken the last couple of years to complete?
So a merger of this scale is a huge deal with a lot of different moving parts and a lot of different people that need to approve things to happen. T-Mobile and Sprint, they needed to get approval from the Department of Justice, the FCC, and then they had a final vote from a federal judge back in February of this year. So, you could look at it as just, oh, two companies are coming together to make one new one. But when we're dealing with two companies that people rely on to make phone calls and text messages, use their mobile data to stay connected while they're not near Wi-Fi. There are just a lot of things that government bodies and people of higher power need to make sure that this is an okay thing to happen, and it's not going to cause consequences down the road that we don't want to see.
Yeah, yeah. So we have Sprint one time. I actually just saw an article earlier today on The Verge that was kind of like a a grand farewell to Sprint, who at one time was kind of the T-Mobile of the networks, right? It was really doing things a lot differently than some of the other networks at the time. Ultimately, you know, T-Mobile came along with John Legere and kind of, you know, took that crown. But so Sprint was strong, and then it kind of weakened a little bit. And now here we are, Sprint is no more. Current Sprint subscribers, what can they look forward to now? Like, is there any immediate effect that they will notice in this transition, or is this more of a longer term transitional thing? What can they look forward to?
So right now, it's definitely going to be a long-term thing. You know, it was a long-term thing getting to this stage, which is very important for what needs to happen to happen. But for the immediate future, if you are a Sprint customer, basically nothing's going to change right now. You get the same plans that you have, the same price you're paying. You can still go to the Sprint website if you need to buy a phone. You can still go to a Sprint retail store. Looking ahead, you know, in the relatively distant future, T-Mobile and Sprint are touting that under the new T-Mobile branding that the capacity for the network should be about 14 times stronger in the next 6 years if you're comparing that to where T-Mobile is on its own right now, which on its own is still better than what current Sprint customers have. And then also in the next coming years, they're touting 5G coverage for 99% of Americans, even in those rural areas, which is something that Sprint has kind of struggled with over the years. So looking ahead, again, in the next years down the road, it's basically going to be more coverage, better speeds, greater capacity. But right now, and as far as we can tell, without any real deadlines or time frame set in stone, it's kind of business as usual until, you know, they really say otherwise.
And Sprint customers, they aren't going to have to make any sort of changes or anything to the phones that they already have. You know, some people might have the suspicion that, hey, my phone's set up for Sprint, and carriers can have the habit or have had the habit of being very specific as far as like, nope, this is a phone for our specific carrier. But that's not going to enter into the equation here. They're going to make this as seamless as possible for the customers, right?
Yeah, they're saying too, yeah, the phone you have now is still going to work. You're not going to have to buy a new phone. If you look through the FAQs and stuff on their website, they're essentially saying that right now, even though they're still under the new T-Mobile company, Sprint's network and towers and devices are basically operating as they do today, still as standalone Sprint, and your T-Mobile phone and network operates as a standalone T-Mobile. Over time, that's going to evolve into the new T-Mobile under the One Network, so it's kind of unclear what happens then if we're going to need to make some sort of switch from CDMA on T-Mobile or on Sprint to GSM on T-Mobile. But right now, and until something changes, it's still Sprint devices are going to work fine. Your T-Mobile devices are going to work fine. And there's nothing that consumers need to worry about changing.
Cool. Well, one thing that I think is going to be changing for consumers, and one thing that always made me like T-Mobile, was the big guy on campus, John. Have we ever learned how to pronounce his last name? Legere,
Legere.
Anyway, good old Johnny guy.
Johnny L is
not going to be the CEO of the new T-Mobile. Do we know anything about what he's going to do next? Is he just going to go, I don't know, become the next Richard Branson? Or what's his whole deal now?
There were rumors and talk a few months ago that he was going to take the CEO position at WeWork, but then those kind of got debunked and sources said that that wasn't going to happen. It's kind of unclear right now what he's going to do. One would assume he still stays in the wireless space or the mobile space to some degree, or he could just do Slow Cooker Sunday full time, his little Twitter cooking show. It's kind of hard to tell. He hasn't really said too much about what he's going to do. Like I said, I would just kind of expect he takes a similar role just because he's been in this business for so many years. WeWork is off the table. He could take a CEO position at another company or do something a little less under the radar. So right now that's kind of unclear of what the future holds for Johnny L or Legere.
I mean, he's such a strong personality. I could see a lot of companies who want to kind of bring some fresh energy into the company. Turning to him would not be a bad choice. He's shown his ability to really take T-Mobile and kind of supercharge it with a lot of electricity, and it's just really works for the brand. Yeah, well, I was going to say, I wonder if he's going to continue wearing magenta T-shirts underneath his sports jacket. That remains to be seen. who is Mike Sievert? He's, of course, the new CEO of T-Mobile. But what do we know about kind of his background and the energy that he can bring to the new T-Mobile?
So in the early days before he was with T-Mobile, he was with AT&T in the early 2000s, from around 2002, 2005. John Legere hired him personally in 2012 to serve as the chief marketing officer. Few years past 2015, he transitions to chief operating officer, and then 2018 he becomes the president for T-Mobile. So he's been around the company and the Un-carrier movement for a while now, and being in the other, you know, executive role has worked closely with John over the years. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see kind of an essence of that whole John Legere stage presence kind of stick with T-Mobile for a little bit, just because this is someone that's worked closely with him and he kind of has a little bit of that energy, if not as exorbitant as John Legere has it. So I would think we can probably look forward to a similar feel, maybe not quite as loud and boastful, but maybe a slightly toned down version of that from him.
Yeah, I'll expect at least a couple of F-bombs, and then he's right on the same playing field.
Definitely.
Don't let us down, Mike. Now, the press release talks of $40 billion of investment, I believe, over the next 3 years, into the network, into the business. And now suddenly we're in a three-horse race. You know, we've got Verizon, we've got AT&T, and we've got the new T-Mobile. So what do you think is kind of the – where does this lead to? Does this ultimately end up serving T-Mobile customers with the better network, with all that funding and the increased competition? Do we see prices going up around the industry as a result of this? What are people kind of concerned about? Because anytime the market gets smaller with fewer major players, and this has been a big concern around the mobile industry kind of consolidating the way it has been, you know, you eliminate choice and you increase the odds that things are going to just pay more because there's less competition to drive those prices down. Is that the concern here? Like, do we see kind of this being the path that's laid in front as a result of this merger?
I mean, there's definitely chatter and people worried about prices going up just because, like you said, if competition ever goes down, it's generally never a good thing, because if there's one less person in the ring you need to worry about, you don't need to be as fierce or as on your foot as you do if you have multiple people coming for your customers, your competition. T-Mobile and Sprint have both said that prices are not going up for the immediate future. They're touting that you're going to get the same benefits and prices you have now, more benefits down the road at the same rate or potentially even lower rates. But I don't think it's silly or unwarranted to be worried about how that changes in the next few years down the road. You know, the coming months and for the rest of the year and probably the year after that, I wouldn't expect prices to go up, and they've both been fairly adamant about that not happening. But it's, again, hard to tell what kind of world the wireless space in the U.S. is going to be once we've had a new T-Mobile working for 3, 4, 5 years, however long it may be. So it wouldn't be to rule out prices at some point down the road. I think it would be pretty easy to see that happening. But for the immediate future, and that's kind of the theme with this whole thing, is that, you know, nothing is changing. The positive end of these two companies coming together, you know, less competition, again, generally not an ideal thing. But living in the world we do now, where 5G is kind of a thing, you know, some companies are trying to roll it out and it is available in certain markets, but the availability and the performance has still shown obvious growing pains. The number that they're throwing around between Sprint and T-Mobile being able to cover 99% of Americans with that 5G coverage, and they're really making it a point to say that this is also going to include people in rural America, which is a market that Sprint is kind of notoriously not been great for. And even T-Mobile to some degree. That's sort of been the area where Verizon reigns supreme, where it has that coverage. Even if you go out in the boonies to the middle of nowhere, you still have service. And they've been touting that when they come together for this 5G service, it can apply to your wireless for your phone. And also they can use 5G for home internet, which is someone that grew up in a town with less than 1,000 people. And my parents are still there with Frontier internet with DSL speeds. That's kind of exciting to hear and to know that we're going to be in a position in the next few years where we can have reliable wireless and potentially home internet service in these generally underserved markets. Is it going to be worth losing one more horse in the race and being down to three major carriers as opposed to four? Remains to be seen. But there are also like obvious benefits of kind of the two underdog or the two mid-range players joining together to kind of form a truer top three, if you want to think about it like that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The timing with 5G, because it still is early. We keep talking about how, you know, the carriers really want to make a big deal about 5G right now. They're setting the path for that. But for users, for subscribers, it's really not as much of a sellable product at this point compared to maybe it'll be where it'll be in a couple of years. And this is timing perfectly with that major investment as a result of this merger. So who knows? The new T-Mobile could come out ahead in that regard. As with most everything we talk about on these shows, it remains to be seen, and we'll be following it closely. Joe Marring with Android Central. Joe, it's great to get you on today. Thank you for taking time with us. Where can people follow your work online?
You can just go to androidcentral.com. I am on there doing news or hands-on reviews, whatever it may be. And Twitter and Instagram is just at JoeMarring1. Nice and simple.
Right on. Joe, awesome. Thank you again. Stay healthy. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Sounds good. Take care.
All right. So the coronavirus does not necessarily afford a whole lot of opportunities for some really positive, good feels stories. But everybody loves a good wedding, right? Why should those people who have planned to tie the knot during this unfortunate time, maybe they had plans scheduled in advance, and suddenly this thing called coronavirus, you know, sweeps the world. And do you postpone your wedding or do you just go forward? And that's what we're going to talk about here with Zoe Schiffer from The Verge, who wrote all about weddings on Zoom. Welcome, Zoe.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to get you on today. So I came across your article, and it was one of the few times that I opened an article that had, you know, Corona or COVID in the headline. And I was like, oh, that's cool that people are able to pull this off. So thank you for writing about this, kind of bringing this to everyone's attention. You spoke to a number of people for your article who were taking, you know, to Zoom specifically, but I'm sure this is happening on other video conference platforms, to speak their vows to the people that they love. How, like, in your experience, like, I know you were kind of tracking a hashtag in Instagram. I'm not sure if that was kind of the entryway into discovering, you know, this world of online weddings. But how common is this right now? Is this kind of increasing, happening more and more? Or are people, you know, more likely to cancel their wedding and wait until a better time?
Yeah, I think it's really common now. I mean, almost everyone that had a wedding scheduled for April, May, or June has had to cancel. And a lot of people I started seeing on Twitter were talking about, oh, we're going to do our nuptials on Zoom, which I thought was really cute. And yes, when I searched the hashtag on Instagram, I saw over 100 photos of people who had either attended a Zoom wedding or had had one themselves. And so I think it's really gaining steam.
So obviously, when you're running a ceremony like a wedding ceremony online, things can get, I imagine, pretty complicated. You attached a couple of screenshots in your article that kind of show the number of people connecting, and then you've got the people who are officiating. Like, how complex do these things get, and do they ever include the post-ceremony stuff? Because, you know, the wedding, the ceremony is one thing. But then it's also getting together and having a drink and eating some food with everybody. Obviously, everybody can't be in the same space, but I could see that also happening in one of these things. Is that happening?
Yeah, I mean, people are pretty limited in what they can do after. One couple, you know, went out to a sushi place that they're trying to support amid coronavirus that's had to close, but it's still doing to-go orders. A lot of people just had a nice dinner at home. You know, nothing's open right now. And so it was really, the ceremony was sweet. And then they got off and they tried to have as much romance as they could. But in terms of the ceremony itself, people kept it pretty simple. You know, they invited a lot more guests than they would have invited to the original wedding, because it was kind of like, come one, come all, we're doing this online, you can join. But the ceremony itself lasted about 15 minutes typically, and it was just them and the officiant on the call.
Nice. That's so cool. Now, okay, so speaking of the officiant, how do you find someone for this? I mean, maybe it's as easy as kind of going the normal route and then just simply asking them, hey, are you willing to do this online? But does that kind of does that pose a problem for these people? Do they already have them lined up? And the officiant was like, yeah, sure, I'll do that. I don't care.
Yeah, most people went with the officiant that they'd originally had, and they had to often teach them how to use Zoom because a lot of people hadn't used it before. But it's pretty easy to use, which is why I think a lot of people are choosing this platform. There is one caveat in that the couple we spoke to in Scotland, they actually have a law that the officiant has to be physically in the room with you. So while they had, a very sweet Zoom wedding, they're actually not legally married yet. They have to wait until the post-coronavirus world to make that happen.
Oh, I could almost see a still coronavirus world where the officiant is on the other side of the front door with their own live stream going.
Oh, my goodness.
It could probably get pretty complicated. And I wouldn't put it past people to try to do that just to make it legitimate and stay safe, of course. What about emotional connection? Obviously, weddings are pretty emotional ceremonies, pretty emotional situations. I find it's easier to connect on a human level face to face than it is online, even though, you know, especially here at Twit, we do this all the time. But I'll still kind of opt for in-person versus over the internet. Were the people that were attending these online weddings, like, did they find like there was a good emotional impact, an easy way for them to connect even remotely on an emotional level to the experience?
Yeah, people were really surprised. And this was actually one of the things that surprised me most. People said, you know, we thought it would be anticlimactic. We thought it would be a letdown. But once the ceremony started, they were completely locked in and it had all of that emotion of a typical wedding. And I think for attendees, it was really a bright spot in an otherwise really dark few months. It was a chance to connect with a bunch of friends, to see something romantic and joyful. And I think all around, people found it to be a really positive experience.
That is so cool. That is so cool. So the people that you spoke with, they've gone through this experience. They have any insight for others who might think to do this? I would imagine, at least in the beginning, people would have looked at the news and then thought, well, I guess we can't have our wedding then. Now there are examples of people who are pulling this off. Do they have any tips to share for people who might want to go this route?
I think the big one is that everyone I spoke to really was glad that they did this. They felt like we didn't want to wait until this is all over, because who knows when that could actually be. And so I think they would first encourage people to move forward if they really do want to have their day still take place. I think the second thing is that people found it to be very important that they mute all of the guests, because there were a lot of people, particularly some older relatives, who didn't really understand how Zoom worked at the very beginning, and having them kind of pipe up in the middle of the ceremony could be a little bit distracting. So setting those things ahead of time was very helpful.
Yeah, and that is one thing that Zoom does afford to the person who is managing or running the particular cast, is that person has the ability to mute everybody else or to choose who's talking at what point. So it gives a good amount of control to the person who's running the event. So that's a good platform for that. However, there's also a lot of news right now. Zoom existed prior to coronavirus, of course, but now during the coronavirus, everybody's been, you know, jumping onto Zoom because it's easy to use. And so you hear about Zoom all the time. And now we're hearing, of course, a lot of pushback, a lot of insight into their practices behind the scenes that maybe aren't, you know, keeping data privacy or security top of mind, that sort of stuff. Did that ever come into play or awareness for the people that you spoke with for your article? Like, were they concerned about this sort of stuff?
They were not. This was something I was also surprised about. You know, in our world, in the tech world, everyone is talking about privacy all the time, and particularly now, privacy on Zoom, security on Zoom. A lot of the couples I spoke to, this was their first time using Zoom at all. And so they weren't really thinking about the privacy and security. They were thinking about the functionality, how it worked, getting people together, but not, you know, what would happen with my data afterwards.
Yeah. And if the ceremony is only 15 minutes, they're like, you know, we'll just jump in. We'll get married. We'll get hitched. Then we'll get out of there before anything happens. So it's all good. I love the story, and I love that people are doing this. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, we're all making do with what we can. We can only do the best that we can do. That's why I'm podcasting in the corner of my master bedroom. That's why people are getting married online in their living room instead of at a chapel and stuff. So I love seeing people be creative like this. And your article put a smile on my face. So I appreciate you writing it. Zoe Schiffer writes for The Verge. So everybody should obviously check out TheVerge.com, find Zoe there. If people want to follow you online, where can they do so?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. It's just my name, at Zoe Schiffer.
Right on. Zoe, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it. Stay healthy.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Story of the week time.
Story of the week. I was going to go into a Rihanna song, but I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm going to spare you all. I'm curious how you feel, Jason, knowing that Apple has acquired Dark Sky, a very popular app on both iOS and Android, and it's going to be completely shutting down the Android version of the app and at some point shutting down the API. So this story broke Tuesday. It was recording iOS Today with Leo, and he brought this story breaking that Apple was acquiring Dark Sky. And I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. And, you know, on its face, it doesn't seem like it's such a big deal, maybe, if you aren't in the know. But if you are in the know, then you know that Dark Sky has a very popular API that powers a lot of different apps, weather apps that are out there, including one of my favorites, one of the tool that I currently use, or that Carrot Weather currently uses, is Dark Sky. And there are other options, and I'll have to switch to one of those eventually. But for right now, my weather forecasts come from Dark Sky. So one of the big things that I saw with this story was the panic, or the complaints, or whatever you want to call it, from people over on Android. And so I'm curious, where do you get your weather on Android right now?
You know, I'm pretty boring when it comes to my weather. I get my weather on the home screen. The built-in widget is just, I don't even know if you can see it, but right up at the top, there's a little sun, and I tap it and I get my forecast, and it's good enough for me. I know a lot of people were really, really bummed out about this, because Dark Sky is a really nice weather app. And, you know, I think as far as Android users being bummed, I think it's kind of indicative of Android users' fear that, like, Apple, the big bad, like, enemy of Android, is coming along and stealing one of our things from us. And, you know, they should have known better. They should have kept it open. Like, they Apple acquired Shazam. And by the way, I don't necessarily feel that way entirely, but Apple acquired Shazam and still kept that open for everyone, but not doing it for Dark Sky, and not really giving much of a warning either. It was kind of like, you know, Dark Sky is going away. We're announcing that Apple has acquired Dark Sky, and it's going away, and you have no real time to, you know, to be remorseful about it. It's just going to stop. You can't find it in the Play Store anymore unless you already had it installed, and very rapidly things are going away. So it feels like the perfect thing to point to and be like, bad Apple. Android's good, Apple bad. But I think, you know, this is business. The developers of Dark Sky created an excellent weather app and service. Yes, a lot of other apps rely on the API for their own apps, and that is a total bummer, although they're giving an extension on the API access, so they're not removing that as quickly as they are the consumer product on Android. So at least there's that. The developers then have the ability and the time to kind of make the changes and the adjustments that they need to. It's not an app that I relied on, so I don't have like a personal, like, bummed out kind of feeling about it on a personal level. But I understand why people are bummed out. And, you know, I mean, bravo to the developers for making something that gets bought by one of the biggest technology companies in the world.
Well put, Jason Howell. Well put. Bravo. Bravissimo. I'm right there with you. As an Apple user, even, I was a little bit concerned about this because, like I said, some of my other apps that I use, like Carrot Weather and things, use Dark Sky because Dark Sky does these great hyper-local weather predictions. And so I was a little bummed to hear about it. But like you said, its acquisition is a fantastic thing for Dark Sky itself, for the developers. And so good on them. What have you got for us?
What have I got? Well, the Internet Archive, which I've talked about as a story of the week a few times. That's just because I think Internet Archive is totally awesome. If you're looking for things to pass the time, which, let's be real, most of us are. It's funny. I was talking just totally as an aside. I made the comment yesterday about how, oh, my God, it's almost Friday again. Like, my weeks are flying by right now because I'm working so much. And my wife, you know, is totally in the opposite camp because she's kind of just doing the day to day in the house. Her business is really slowed down. So she's with the kids kind of doing learning and everything. And she kind of feels like everything is creeping by. So I don't know. Your experience may vary whether you feel like you have enough time to read a bunch or not, because I think we're all in different situations. But the Internet Archive is a great place to go if you're looking for free content. And particularly now, you know, we've talked about free classic arcade games that you can play through the browser, console games, old school computer OS games that you can like check out, all these things that are playable through the Internet Archive, completely free. You can totally burn some time doing that. Oregon Trail is on there, the original Oregon Trail. So I'm going to have my kids play that. But they also house millions of ebooks. And right now they're actually opening up something they're calling the, the virtual library? No, is that what it's called? The National Emergency Library, that's what it's called. So basically they have millions of these ebooks that normally they have a wait list for, because it essentially operates just like a library, right? They've procured all of these books. In many cases, they've scanned these books into ebook for the first time ever, so they're only available through the Internet Archive. But they put wait lists on these. They only allow a certain number of people to check them out at a time. Usually it's a two-week checkout, and then, you know, you have to kind of go through that process similar like you would at any normal library. They are legally considered a library. But as you know, public libraries are all shut down right now. For the most part, you can't go into a public library, which essentially has all the books that are in those libraries on like inaccessible to people, and especially inaccessible at a time when people might really enjoy having access to it, or maybe students need access to certain materials and they can't get that now that school's kind of started up again. So the Internet Archive has removed the wait list for all of their books. They're extending this removing of the wait list until June 30th of this year, or they say the end of the U.S. national emergency, whichever is later. And essentially it means that you can go to the Internet Archive and you can find their books, any books that they have listed there, check them out essentially indefinitely until the national emergency call is over. And, you know, you aren't hurting for stuff to read and for free. So I don't know. It's just it's kind of an interesting time right now where all these services are offering things completely free. So if you're looking for free content and something to kill the time, right now is a really good time to do that because it's coming in from all directions. Libby is an app that I love. That still allows you to connect to your public library through your mobile phone, and they have audiobooks, ebooks, all that kind of stuff. I think I'm going to do a hands-on Android that kind of summarizes a number of different ways, at least on Android, and I think extends beyond Android as well, but a number of ways that you can find media online for free right now while you've got the time to kill.
Cool. All right. Well, I know what I'm going to be doing.
You're going to be reading, but you still have a job to do, Micah. So, Darn it. Fine. Like maybe
sneak that in
around. You're podcasting.
I guess I'll try.
So anyway, it's worth checking out. Do a search for Internet Archive National Emergency Library, and you'll find millions of ebooks that you can check out right now and get to reading. Sweet. So that is that. And with that, we've reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. We appreciate you watching and listening each and every week. You can find us at twit.tv/TNW. That is the site that you can go to subscribe to the show. That's the most important thing. Subscribe to the podcast. Find us on YouTube. Subscribe there. Ultimately, we want to make sure that we're pushing our content to your eyes and your ears, even throughout all of this, because we realize, you know, this pandemic is throwing off people's habits and rituals and everything. This is a great way for you to kind of escape that a little bit and get a sense of normalcy and return back to what you are used to, which is listening to us each and every week. We hope that you do that. twit.tv/TNW.
I just saw a tweet yesterday where someone said that their roommate was sitting on their bed and listening to their commute podcast while staring straight forward. So they were pretending as if they were in their car on their commute to work. So if you would like to do that, you very much can do that. Just simply sit down on your bed, pretend you're getting into your car, put on your headphones and listen to us and your other favorite podcasts while you go on your daily commute.
Or just get into your car. Turn it on.
Yeah, get into your car. Make sure if you're in a garage, though, you need to lift that door. Yeah.
Be safe.
Just turn on the accessory, I guess. But then you might run your battery dead. Maybe don't get in your car.
Maybe that's a bad idea.
You can do a trip around the neighborhood or something. I don't know. But you can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. And of course, follow us on social media. We are at Twit on Twitter. We are at twit.tv on Instagram. We are at Twit Talk on TikTok. I am at Micah Sargent at pretty much all of the things. Later today, the inimitable John Ashley will have finished the production of Hands on iOS, so you can check that out. It'll go up later today. Thank you to John Ashley for really making that show shine. It means a lot to me. And Jason Howell, where can people find you online?
At Jason Howell on Twitter. Also, big thanks to John Ashley for his hard work on Hands on Android. He's got his hands on a lot of hands on shows.
yes.
So we appreciate your work, John. This week's episode of Hands on Android went up today, twit.tv/HOA. If you have one of the new Galaxy S20 smartphones, any one of them, this episode is for you. It's kind of ways to set up your phone when you remove it from the box, so things aren't quite as, I don't know, sometimes they're a little annoying as the way that Samsung has it set by default. So I'll walk you through some of my favorite setting tweaks. So check that out, twit.tv/HOA. Big thanks also to Burke, who's in the studio helping. Of course, John, producing this show behind the scenes. And thanks to you in the chat, watching video, listening to audio, listening to live stream, whoever you happen to be. Thanks for checking out Tech News Weekly. We'll see you all next week. Take care, everybody.